listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, episode 89, interview with Christopher Knights. Welcome to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, and everything in between. My name is Mason Smith, and I am your host for today, and I'm here with my two lovely co-hosts, Oh, crap. Oh, they're not here on this episode. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Rotoscopers fans, this is a historical episode. I am flying solo, as they say. On this episode, unfortunately, Morgan couldn't make it, neither could Chelsea, and so I picked up a Skype call recorder, and I was working with Christopher Knights from DreamWorks, who I'm interviewing on this episode, and so please excuse me if I sound awkward or if it gets a little weird, because I'm kind of flying into unknown territories. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I really miss having Chelsea and Morgan, but not that this is gonna be a regular thing. Like, I definitely do not plan on doing solo episodes, you know, because I love the triumvirate of myself, Morgan, and Chelsea, and mostly because they don't ramble on about dumb things like I'm doing now. And so, yeah, special treat for you guys today. It's kind of a surprise interview, with this guy, Christopher Knights from DreamWorks. You know him best, from one of the most memorable comedic, quartets of all time in animation. And those are the Penguins from Madagascar. That's right. Christopher Knights is the voice of Private the Penguin. Oh my gosh, I chuckle just thinking about it, because Private's like, he's like the cutest and cuddliest one, but he's also the kind of naive one, you know what I mean? And so, fascinating interview with this guy, because I didn't know this after getting a hold of him, but he started out as a camera operator for Amblimation, for those old 2D films, like We're Back and Balto, and he eventually moved on to work for DreamWorks as a CG animation editor, and that is a fascinating job, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about his old days at Amblimation, we're going to talk about his voice work for Private, and lots of fun stuff, and we're also going to go a little bit into the Mumbai musical, which was shut down by, unfortunately, it was, they halted production for it at DreamWorks, and we're going to hear his remarks on that. But, man, just a fascinating interview, and I want to thank Christopher for being on the show. But, yeah, let's not waste any more time, and we're going to launch right into this awesome interview with Christopher Knights.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast, called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making Just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Hi, Mason. Thanks a lot for inviting me on. And firstly, I would just like to say you guys do an amazing job, and it really is quite an honor to be asked onto your show.
Oh, shucks. It is really an honor having you, sir, and yeah, we appreciate it. So I take it from your accent that you're from Alabama.
Yeah, that's right. I was born and bred and spent all my life down south there. Yeah, I grew up in London, spent 22 years there, came over here with the Amblimation crew that was being relocated to start DreamWorks back in January of 96.
Yeah.
And the original plan was just to, you know, I had an 18-month contract to work on Prince of Egypt, and the original plan was just to come over, work that contract, and, you know, see a bit of the world and then go home again. And here I am 19 years later, an American citizen, living the dream in California.
All right, man. Congrats. So, yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
All right, so you, having listened to all these episodes, you know you're not going to get out of Catching Fire. We're going to do this.
That's fine.
It is a painful part of these interviews that everyone has to go through, because we're the podcast that asks the hard questions.
Well, no, it's funny because having listened to the other ones, like, they're never as Catching Fire as you want them to be. And
editing helps a lot.
Exactly. And I've listened and I thought, well, how will I answer that question? Let me get ready with my answers so that we can just, you know, bounce off each other back and forth and try and make it quick fire like you want it to be.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's do this. I've adapted some of them to be more DreamWorks centric for you. So we'll keep you on your toes.
Let's make sure the questions aren't too hard then.
All right.
All right. I'm ready.
Well then, how about a quick round of Catching Fire? Catching Fire? You mean me? You're the only one with enough courage.
Yeah, Chris, first animated movie you remember seeing?
It wasn't fully animated, but it was Pete's Dragon, and I fell in love with it.
Wow, oh, man.
Yeah.
As an American, rednecks really are like that out in, down in the South. Anyway, haven't bathed in 3 months.
Exactly.
Anyway. Favorite cartoon growing up?
Did you guys get D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers?
D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers?
Yeah, it might have been a French cartoon that got dubbed into English, but I remember that as a kid growing up. Used to love that one.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, favorite animated movie of all time? This is the big one.
You know what? Just because it's so close to my heart, I have to say Shrek.
Spent
4.5 years working on it. Got to, you know, become an editor through that process and a voice actor through that process. So Shrek, definitely.
I keep petitioning for a Shrek episode, and we're going to have it soon, so stay tuned. Don't worry.
You have to.
I love Shrek as one of my, like, top five. It's not even lying.
It's a seminal animated movie, you know. One of the first fully CG'd, but also the first one to win an animated Oscar.
Yeah, good point.
And like Ricky Bobby said, if you aren't first, you're last.
Yeah, there you go.
We got the first one.
Let's see. Favorite animator / artist?
Oh, wow.
Someone you really admire.
So many of them. And, you know, I'm not a traditional animation nerdy fan type guy.
Sure.
So please excuse me, but Christophe Sarand.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, classic animation, like 2D hand-drawn or CG?
Both. I think there's a market for both of them. I think it's a shame that we have put all of our chips into the one basket and gone fully CG.
Yeah.
I think the traditional style and some of the stuff that guys can do with a pencil is so much more interesting and fascinating to what people can do with a computer.
Yeah. You know what? You know, going back to, you know, the decision to, you know, to shut down PDI and then all these postponements, I was really disappointed about Me and My Shadow. Like, that just sounded so cool.
Absolutely. You know, I'd completely forgotten about that movie. It's been a couple of years since that one went away, but what they were doing technically on that one was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So, yeah, I think there's a marketplace for both 2D and 3D.
Excellent. All right. Yeah. Would you choose Disney or Pixar?
I prefer the Pixar movies to what Disney specifically are doing. I'm more an action movie kind of guy, so Incredibles rather than princess movies.
Oh, Pixar. Man. When Incredibles 2 comes out, man, I'm gonna watch it like 10 times. All right, Studio Laika or Studio Ghibli? You know, Miyazaki, formerly Miyazaki.
Oh, Ghibli, absolutely.
All right.
You know what? Can I change my answer to my favorite animated movie of all time?
Sure.
My Neighbor Totoro.
Oh man, that one's so good.
My Neighbor Totoro is one that I watched as a dad with both of my girls as they grew up, and so that one's a good one.
All right, Disneyland Anaheim or Disney World?
World by a country mile.
All right.
There's just so much more to do.
Yeah.
And all the other parks around it as well. You know, yeah. World, definitely.
Absolutely. Heroes or villains in animation?
Villains.
Okay. Let's see. Alex, Marty, or Melman?
Marty.
All right. I love Marty.
Is he black with white stripes or white with black stripes?
No one knows. I went to the San Diego Zoo a couple of weeks ago, and I still couldn't figure it out. Let's see. Okay. Favorite little-known obscure animated character?
Oh, my goodness.
And you can't say Private anymore because he's not obscure. They got their own movie.
No, I'm. You've stumped me. I'm kind of thinking of one of the little mice in Cinderella.
Oh yeah, there's Gus Gus and then Jock.
Gus Gus, yeah,
he's great.
Big fan of Gus Gus.
All right. All right. Do you like people in animated films or anthropomorphic animals?
Both. I've done movies with both. You know, we're back was a crossover between people and dinosaurs, so it doesn't get more diverse than that.
All right.
When we're done, I wanna just say something about We're Back.
Yeah.
But next question.
Absolutely. Songs or no songs in animation?
It all depends on the style of the movie. I mean, I was working on the Mumbai musical, so we had songs in there and they were relevant to the story and they were a very big part of the movie. And so if they're done right, definitely songs.
All right. Here's a big one. Who would win in a fight? King Fergus from Brave or Stoic the Vast from How to Train Your Dragon?
Because I've got Scottish blood in my veins, I would have to say Stoic, definitely.
Stoic is a mighty man.
Absolutely.
He has the girth of a Viking barge.
You don't mess with the Scots, that's for sure.
All right. Let's see. Here's one. Here's my final question. Who's better, Dave or King Julian? Both gigantic personalities.
You know what? I'm going to have to say Julian, but it's only because I had the privilege of seeing and hearing Sacha Baron Cohen recording some of his early sessions. And that guy is absolutely phenomenal. He's just absolutely phenomenal. He's such a great talent. And he went off on this thing. He was in session, you know, he was doing everything that we were asking him to do, you know, dialogue-wise and that. And then, you know, it was one of the early sessions, so they're developing the character. And he went off on this thing about Julian being a recording artist on the island of Madagascar. And he broke into song. And he did this whole shtick for about 10 minutes, and he did some fantastic stuff in that in those early sessions, and that's why he became Julian and made that character such a great character for the Madagascar films.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, thanks for sticking through our Catch and Fire. I know it's a tough gauntlet for people to run through, but you did just fine.
Thank you. No, it was fun.
Out of 52! Well done!
I was looking over, I guess, your IMDb page and some of the other stuff that you've done, and you have been around for a long time. I think your first gig was like a line checker for We're Back with Amblimation.
Well, yeah, I was hired as a show or a studio runner, like a PA.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was photocopying, making tea, or doing any menial tasks that any of the animators at the studio required of me, including, you know, dropping clothes into the dry cleaners and picking up lunch for people here and there. And after 3 months of that, I had the opportunity to start working my way up through the studio. And, you know, there was a position available on the line testing department. And yeah, it just really went from there. I'd always kind of really wanted to be a cameraman and be behind, you know, behind the camera and do more of the technical side of stuff. And so to have that opportunity after just 3 months at the studio was great. And I jumped at it and have worked my way up through the ranks to where I am today.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So you got to work with Steve Hickner on a lot of those movies, I'm assuming. He's kind of a, I don't know, he's kind of a legend around with the rotoscoper because he was one of our first big interviews that led to a lot of things.
Absolutely. And one of the nicest, sweetest guys you will meet in the business. Yeah. Who, you know, he's done... Over the years, he's kept me working, basically, you know, in between feature films when there have been little downtime periods at DreamWorks. And, you know, if it wasn't for Steve and his short projects that we worked on together, me as his editor and him directing, you know, I may not be in animation as it is today, you know. But we did the Book of Dragons, which was a short that went on the DVD. And we came in and, you know, we had to rework that when we started work, when we got that one. And then earlier this year, we did the Got Your Six PSA that went out around Veterans Day, which was based on the Penguins. And that was a trip, you know, because that was the first time I actually got to be an editor and a voice actor in the same project.
All right.
And so I had carte blanche with my own dialogue. And it was quite funny because there were a couple of times where Steve would say, you know, I'd go through and pick all the best takes that I preferred, how I wanted myself to sound. And Steve would come in and say, is there a different read of that line? And I'd just be like, no, Steve, that's the best there is. And come on, Chris, let's have a listen to the others. I'm like, no, Steve, that's the best there is. And all right, I gave in, played some of the other takes for him. And he said, you know what? You picked the best one in the first place. So... But, you know, with the other guys, with Skipper, Tom McGrath and Kowalski, Chris Miller, you know, we'd just have a lot of fun with that kind of stuff. And the Penguins are such great characters. And, you know, like I say, being an editor and an actor in the same thing was a little bit of a trip, but we got around it and, you know, it was a lot of fun. And I think that PSA had quite good feedback. So we did our job.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, so you were like a camera operator for those 2D films like Balto, Prince of Egypt.
So that was an interesting time as well, because when I got to the studio, I think they were mid-production on We're Back. So that was my first job in the animation business, or first movie at least. And we were still shooting 35mm camera.
Yeah.
But... I guess it was toward the end of that production that they teamed up with AFT, who were based in San Diego, that did colorization of old black and white movies. And we brought their technology in, basically, because they decided we were going to go digital with our cameras and we were going to colorize everything after the fact. So there was no more, you know, cell animation or whatever. Well, none of it was cell animation at that time. They'd always planned on doing... you know, the painting by numbers, coloring everything after they've scanned it. And, it was one of the first movies to switch over to digital scanning, as they used to call it. I mean, you didn't even really get the proper title of being a camera operator, because it was, you know, it was just a down shooter camera on a fixed axis that didn't move, and on a flatbed camera. And you would just put the, yeah, every frame of the movie is on a separate piece of paper.
Yeah.
Based on how they work their bonus schemes at Emblemation. So every single character was on a separate piece, even within a scene together. If there are three or four characters on screen in a 50-foot scene, every single one of them was on a separate piece of paper. So that 50-foot scene became a 150-foot scene because you had to scan all three of those levels, you know, and then you had all the effects levels and stuff on top of that. So we ran cameras 24 hours a day. We're back, I think it was 2 12-hour shifts, and then when we went on to Balto, 3 8-hour shifts. And we never wanted the night shift. It was not fun.
Wow.
It was fun. It was a lot of learning and, you know, you know, working with great people in the camera department there, all still friends today, you know. So we made the most of it, but, you know, having to be having to be on a 12-hour night shift starting at 7 p.m. on a Friday night, and your friends are all going out and doing stuff, and you want to hang out with them, you know, I have to admit I did call in sick a couple of times.
All right, man. Well, you know, I'm curious about the transition that you must have had going from like a 2D camera operator for film and then moving into CG with DreamWorks, where it's all digital, and then, you know, not necessarily operating the camera anymore, but editing. So what was that transition like?
So like I mentioned earlier, I moved to America in 96. I guess we finished Balto in 95. That one came out, I think, later at the end of 95. And they basically, the way it worked was they were starting the studio. Jeffrey came over and met all the departments as a group, like individual department meetings at a hotel in London, and pitched Prince of Egypt to us. And I think by that point, we had all signed our contracts, those of us that were going to be moving. And that was kind of like a, you know, this is what you're going to be working on when you get there. So they needed a crew, you know, they needed people to fill every position at the studio. They weren't able to, you know, go to the other bigger animation studios and take the talent and the technical staff, you know, to start DreamWorks. I guess there would have been a conflict of interest there or whatever. So there was a good sizable amount of people that came over from Emblemation, because there was a crew over there, obviously, that was going to be at a studio that it was shutting down, and came over as a Prince of Egypt digital scan operator. So in between Balto and Prince of Egypt, we'd literally gone from shooting on the fixed aspect downshooter to glorified photocopying, is the only way you really can describe it. So once again, you'd get handed a piece of, you know, a stack of paper with all the hand-drawn animation on it, and you would just run it through a machine. And it got to the point where the machine feeders were automatic. And so I was doing that for about 6 months, and I have to admit, it was mind-numbingly boring. There wasn't much to learn, and I was questioning to myself, why did I move to America to run a photocopy machine, you know? And yeah. The opportunity was given to me by a very dear friend, Sim Evan-Jones, who was the lead editor on Shrek, to go and join him as the apprentice editor in his editorial department. And, you know, he mentored me for 4.5 years whilst we worked on Shrek together, and, you know, both in Glendale and up at PDI. And, yeah, I went from apprentice editor to film assistant, because even though everything was digital, we was shooting out to 35 mil still, all the finished product. And that was interesting and different, and cut my fingers a few times splicing 35 mil together. But, you know, it makes you the person you are today. And so in the meantime, I was making sure I learned as much of the Avid software and inner workings of the editorial department as I possibly could. And he once described me as a sponge for information, which yeah. I've never forgotten. And I always took on, you know, no matter what the challenge was, however menial or difficult it may be. And, you know, just worked my way up through the different departments and learnt the computer, because I knew everything was going to be going digital. 35 mil was going away. You know, track reading had died. You know, traditional track reading had died. And so it was an interesting time crossing over, because Shrek was really one of the first movies where we still, even though we were fully digital, we were still shooting out to 35 mil to finish the job off. And, you know, nowadays everything just goes on a hard drive and prints computer files off a hard drive.
Yeah, awesome. And so now, so you did, you've done editing from like you said, Shrek up until like Megaminds. That was 2010. And
well, here's a funny thing. I haven't ever stopped editing.
Okay.
I've still remain at DreamWorks, even though my last feature credit is Megamind in 2010. So after Megamind finished, I mentioned the Book of Dragons earlier.
Oh, right, yeah.
So that was one of those moments where I could have possibly left DreamWorks, but Steve had a project that he wanted me to work on with him. And so, Book of Dragons took about 9 months and started in the fall of 2010 through to the summer of 2011. And then I did some miscellaneous, you know, consumer products, marketing type stuff for the guys at DreamWorks. I can't remember what movie was finishing, but, you know, in between projects, they've always kept me busy with that kind of thing, cutting commercials and little TV spots and stuff. And then in the January of 2012, the editor that I've worked with since the end of Shrek, so Sim went off to go and be the editor for Andrew Anderson on the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe series. And since then, so I've worked with Mike Andrews. And, you know, again, he's mentored me, taken me under his wing, and I've kind of become his right-hand man over the years. And so, you know, we'd worked on all the Shrek films and Megamind together. And we went on to Trolls. I don't know if you guys know too much about that one, but...
Yeah, we knew a little bit about it.
There was a series of books called The Bromeliad that was written by Terry Pratchett. A series of three books that DreamWorks had optioned the rights 2 years ago. And I think it took 10 years between them optioning the rights to actually going into production on a story based on those characters. And during the year that we were on that movie, they decided that they wanted to incorporate the little troll doll figures to be the main characters of that film rather than the, you know, designed characters that we were working with that the, you know, the art department had been doing. So there was a switch over there in the middle of the production or the story development phase, and we went back to kind of reworking the script and stuff. And so there was going to be some downtime at the end of 2012. And then that was the year on, Trolls done. And then we went from there to start of 2013. And as a crew, thankfully, we all moved over and we've just completed 2 years of the Monkeys of Mumbai musical movie, which is completely different and interesting.
Yeah.
We can get into talking more about that in a bit if you want, but
oh yeah,
yeah, we've done two years of story on that one, and then unfortunately that was one of the victims of the changes that DreamWorks is going through now, and they will not be moving forward with production on that film.
Yeah,
so it's not that I haven't been editing in the last 3 years; it's just I haven't been lucky enough to work on a movie that's finishing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cool. Yeah.
That was a very long-winded way of answering that question, wasn't it? But
No, we love long-winded. Yeah, man. Okay, so for those of us who don't have, like, any clue, like, how important is the editorial department at DreamWorks, like, in film production?
It's funny you should ask that, because we learned whilst up at PDI doing Shrek, just how important the people in the Silicon Valley, the tech guys, how important they value or they envisage our work to be, because obviously down in LA everything is movie orientated, and you know, a very large percent of the industry works in that city. So we moved up to the, you know, the dot-com industry home base of the Silicon Valley, and we were making a movie. You know, we were out of our element as far as a film studio goes. And the editorial department at the building we were at PDI was literally across the corridor from editorial was the render farm, which had all the servers, all the computers in there where they were rendering all the frames for the movie. And they'd have these quite regular tours come through. And there was a closed door down at the end of the corridor, and you'd hear the door open, and the tour guide would say, "We'll now take you into editorial here and show you this area." And they'd walk down the corridor, and the render farm was like a big open glass wall, basically. You could see all the machines in there. And our editing rooms, they were just doorways where you could stick your head in and just see what the editors were doing. And so the tour guide, the script was pretty much, on our right, we see We have the editorial department. This is where they add sound to the movies. And on our left is the render farm. This is where they make the film. And we would always laugh because, you know, as editors, we do so much more than just adding sound to picture. And you know, a lot of these people in the, no disrespect to anyone who gave a tour at PDI, but they didn't give them a very good script for the tour. Let's just put it that way. We would always laugh and cry and chuckle to ourselves, you know, when we would hear that line, this is where they added sound, because, you know, we were working 14, 16 hour days on Trek, and there was a lot of work being done, and it was so much more than just adding sound. It's unbelievable. You know, you're having to sculpt the story all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're working with every single 1/24th of a second is important to everything that you're doing, you know. And so for it to be so blatantly or flippantly disregarded as just adding sound to picture is something that we always used to find quite comical.
Yeah. Well, describe for me like a typical day in the editorial department at DreamWorks. Like, what's your day in, day out job editing?
So, I mean, it depends on what phase of production you're in. In the story development production, and it would always, of course, depend on what your deadlines are and where you left off the night before. But we normally, you know, start around 9 o'clock. Coffee, bit of a chat as a department, you know, divide up the daily duties to everybody. And then, you know, once we get into it, you know, for the 2 years of the Monkey musical movie, we're cutting storyboards, you know, so you'd receive a new sequence, you know, the night before or that morning, and you'd just get into trying to build the sequence, you know, first pass as best you possibly can. And, you know, just lock yourself away in a dark room and get your head down and try and build a movie, you know, and searching for dialogue, reads that fit the tone of the scene that you're trying to build. And then, you know, we do all our own sound effects and music, temp stuff for animation, because we need to try and make it play as it would the finished article, you know, so that when we have work in progress screenings with the executives, you know, they have a more full idea of what the scenes are or what the movie is. So yeah, so start early, work all day, order dinner, work all night, go home, sleep, come back, start again. I mean, unfortunately, there isn't really anything typical to any one day, because every day is different. You know, in the early stages of story development, you're also trying to cast the parts, and that's always quite a big deal. You know, getting casting clips of various different actors from various different movies and building little radio play sequences with them, reading against each other, you know, lead male, lead female, a villain, you know, and you're trying to see, you're, you know, giving yourself an idea of what these guys are going to sound like together should they get cast for parts in your film. You know, so in the early stages of production, there's that involved. And then, you know, we'll get conceptual art from the art department, and you know, we'll have to cut little show reels together of the artwork of the films that we're working on, because they'll have little showcase screenings for producers or executives just to show where the movie is at any certain time. And, you know, so we put art reels together and cut them with music. And then with the Monkees thing, it was quite typical, for want of a better word, that we had a Bollywood movies running on a TV in our department all day long, 24/7, just streaming off of Netflix.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was really interesting, because they have a very specific style to them, in my opinion. A lot of them, well, they either do straight out comedy or action, but a lot of the time within the action, it's very comedic as well. And they'll just, you know, do what they break all the rules as far as movie making goes. Again, in my opinion, yeah, they break all the rules and they make no apology for stopping for song for 10 minutes or however long it may be. But you know, they break out into these huge elaborate dance numbers, and the whole cast, the heroes and the villains of any particular piece will all get together and start singing a song and dancing. And a lot of the time, you know, rain falling, and everyone on set is absolutely soaking wet. Or there's even a couple that they have scenes in the sea, and there's like a big dance number and a crowd of like 20, 30 actors all standing in the sea dancing to this whatever the song is this. You know,
that's awesome.
So it's a very different way of making films. And you know, I don't know if DreamWorks was I don't think DreamWorks wanted to make an out and out comedy like that particularly, but also we were basing our version of this monkey movie on it had a religious through line. There's an Indian story called the Ramana or something. Ramana. I'm sorry, I'm not getting the name right. But anyway.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's Hanuman and Ravana is the demon god. And once you start going to that place with religious tones and themes in your movies, and certainly basing a story around that, you're kind of hands are tied a little bit with your artistic interpretation of that story. You're not as free to do whatever it is that you want to do story-wise, because you have to kind of stay true to what is written. You know, it would be remiss of us as a Western company to make an Indian-themed movie and change up their, you know, you don't want to turn their religious story into an out-and-out slapstick comedy, Keystone Cops type thing.
Sure.
You know, so you've got to stay true to that. And I think, you know, ultimately, unfortunately, that was probably somewhat responsible for the downfall of that film. And, you know, it's certainly a shame that it won't see the light of day in the version that we were making, because it was certainly very different. And, you know, there was a level of entertainment there for people. But, you know, I think the hardest part of all of it through the development that we, you know, as far as we got, was how are we going to market this film to a wider audience and actually, you know, ultimately make money from it one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've seen one Bollywood film in my life. It was called Rowdy Rawthor, and it was exactly as you described Bollywood. It was like 3.5 hours long. It had extremely bloody, intense action sequences, but also random dance numbers, like with very little time between shifting gears.
Absolutely, and they come out of nowhere. They last forever, and you're like, okay, what's the song about exactly? Someone just got slaughtered, you know. they just chopped someone up into pieces, and now we're singing about it, you know.
It's right, man.
And in some ways, it's great to have that kind of freedom to just do whatever it is that you want to do.
Well, yeah, that's why we were so excited about Mumbai Musical when we first heard about it, because we were like, man, this is going to be so different. Like, they can do anything with this.
Yes, yes. And when we first heard about it, you know, when I first heard of the concept, I thought it was going to be a very different movie to the one that we started making. But, you know, one thing led to another, and we found ourselves, you know, with no Monkey Musical coming out, but maybe one day they'll rekindle a similar idea or try something a bit different and try and reach out to that audience again, because there certainly is an audience there. It's just a question of how wide it is in the Western world, you know?
Yeah.
It'd be great if one day some of the bigger studios took more chances with stories like that, because, you know, a lot of the time we're now getting into, you know, please feed us an original idea, territory with a lot of our animated movies. You know, we've had the superheroes, we've had the princesses, you know, we've had the witches and the, you know, it's the hardest part of it is coming up with that original idea that is going to sell, which, you know, when we get to talking about penguins, you know, it's just it's such a shame that that movie didn't reach a bigger audience domestically. I mean, I think worldwide it's going to probably hit about 350 million total.
Yeah.
You know, and in whose world is that kind of money ever a failure, you know?
Right.
But domestically, it made its money back. And, you know, unfortunately, DreamWorks is having to take a write-off on that film as well. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe you can tell me, because I don't understand what went wrong or why people didn't go out and see that film.
Well, I thought it was a charming idea, you know, getting the... Because, like, when Madagascar first came out, like, sure, like, Alex and Marty and all that stuff was really funny, but it was these, like, four little penguins who were voiced by people that nobody knew that were just this runaway hit. And then, of course, you got King Julian. So you had, like, these three different stories in Madagascar that people could just, like, relate to and, like, laugh at and stuff. And but, man, the penguins, like, when I first got out of the theater, I was like, I got to go get a penguin stuffed animal for my girlfriend. Like, this is back in the day, you know? And just adorable. And we would just laugh all the way for the car because of the penguins. And then the idea of having, you know, like, the backstory and then having them, like, really become secret agents. And then I thought it was a hilarious idea. And then I really thought that domestically it would have banked on Senor Cumberbatch, who is extremely popular these days.
Yes.
And there are a few other stars within that professional spy group that classifies the head of Northwind, that one. But I thought that, you know, the combination of having the backstory and having the adorable baby penguins at the beginning and then having Cumberbatch, I don't know, man. Either we give it time or I don't know, because I know that some animated films that don't do well domestically are smash hits internationally. And I don't know how that works.
It seems to be where we're at with this one. But it's funny you should make that point about people not knowing who we were as voice, you know, actors.
Yeah.
Quick story from my experience at the premiere, okay, in New York. So
for Penguins, right?
For Penguins.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the first time ever, I'm actually at one of these events as talent, in inverted commas. Or parentheses, as you guys like to say. So we do the screening. We get taken over to the press event, which is at Bryant Park in New York. And, you know, there's a press line. And basically it was a case of if I wanted to do anything on the press line, I could. I mean, I don't think I was obliged to if I wasn't comfortable with it. And certainly being on camera and doing that kind of stuff isn't natural to me, you know, but we get to the event and I walk in, there's no one there to kind of show me the way, and I bumped into a couple of guys from DreamWorks marketing and I said, you know, do I need to do anything, do you want me to? And he's like, well, why don't you go up and take a picture with the penguin, because at the start of the press line they had the penguin, the guys
in the suits,
exactly, go up and take a picture. And then, you know, if you want to do any interviews, you know, come and talk to DreamWorks TV at least, you know. Okay, I'll do that, fine. So stepping up onto the stairs there to go and have my picture taken with the penguin, there's a lady who's organizing people in turn going up. And so I went up to her and I said, look, I've been told to come up and take a picture with the penguin, you know. And she looked at me, she's like, so who are you? And I'm like, oh, Chris Knights, voice of Private. And she's like, oh, great, great. Great, yeah, come on up. So I finally make it up to the penguin, and there's the photo journalists are all there with their, you know, ready for the people to step up to the penguin. There's one guy in a group of about 20 taking a picture, and so I'm standing there smiling for everybody else, and I'm thinking, okay, when the one guy clears, when he gets out of the way, everybody else will start taking their pictures. Well, the one guy got out of the way. And no one else was taking pictures at all. And I'm standing there like a complete lemon, with my arm around this penguin.
Oh, no.
Waiting for these pictures to get taken, and it's just not happening. And, you know, inside I'm just dying for a moment because I'm like, I don't know what to do myself at this point. And so I just kind of shuffled off out of the way. And, you know, I don't think I think the one picture that the guy took of me with the penguin did actually make it out onto the internet. And then through the course of the afternoon, I ended up going back up on the carpet with Chris Miller, who was Kowalski.
Yeah.
We took a picture with the penguin together, and then I got another picture when I went up with my family later on in the evening. So they did end up taking some photos, but the first initial experience of standing in front of all these guys, waiting for them to press the gutter buttons and then not doing so was probably one of the worst moments. And I wasn't humiliated. I won't go so far to say that, but it was just very embarrassing.
Nothing like an awkward red carpet moment, man.
Well, that led me to I was doing one interview with a lady that I don't think it ever got out because I was just stumbling and bumbling my way through her questions. But one of her questions was, you know, what's the best part of doing a voice for these movies? And I said, you know what? Actually, it's that nobody knows who I am. Because I get to have the anonymity of, you know, going to the microphone and doing my thing, getting all the glory of being Private Penguin, you know, and then I can walk down the street and go to the supermarket and I'm not being hassled and bothered because I'm not sure I would be completely comfortable with that, you know?
Right. Whereas, you know, Penguin's had John Malkovich and Benedict Cumberbatch, like, they really can't go to the market without being...
Exactly. And so we were in the hotel leading up to the event. We had a couple of nights at the hotel before the event on the Sunday. And I think it was the Friday night, and John Malkovich was standing on the other side of the foyer, obviously waiting for someone to meet him so they could go for dinner or whatever it was they were doing. On me, and obviously people were recognizing him, and he wasn't left alone for a moment. Like, people were walking over and saying hi, and, you know, I don't think people went so far as to ask for photographs with him, but yeah, he was, you know, though you have to be, you know, very patient, I guess, I think is the right way of saying it with a lot of people, because they just get into your personal space a lot of the time, and they don't consider that you have a life outside of being the guy that they see on camera all the time, you know. So it must be awkward and uncomfortable for them to have to do that a lot. And I'm just glad I don't have to, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a cool life. Like, on the podcast, we frequently talk about, like, man, it must be great to be like a voice actor for animation because people know you as the character.
Right.
But like you said, you can still walk down the street or go to a screening of your movie and not be harassed by people, unless they're like hardcore creepy fans who know who you are.
Oh my goodness, it was it was the best moment, of the weekend in New York for me. Was we're leaving the as the afternoon event progressed, and we're, you know, Tom and Chris and I were at the doing the press line. Tom had to do a lot more interview stuff than either Chris or I. But it ended up the end of the evening, the three of us got to take our picture with Benedict. And then kind of after that, when he left, it was kind of over. And so we were all walking out together, Tom, Chris and I, and our respective, my family, and Chris had his family and Tom had his girlfriend with him. And we were all walking out, and there were a couple of autograph hunters who ran up to Tom and basically produced stacks of photographs from these bags that they were holding for him to sign. And this was happening like 10 yards in front of us when Chris and I kind of looked at each other, and I was thinking, oh, well, maybe someone was going to ask us for an autograph. And and we just kept walking slowly, and as we got past these guys, neither of them, you know, turned to us and said, hey, do you mind signing some of these for us? And we were able to just walk past Tom as he was stuck there signing stuff and go and get in our cars and back to the hotel. So that was, for me, that was a hysterical moment that will never be forgotten, because, you know, there was the opportunity for the autograph hunters there, but they never took it.
That's awesome. So yeah. While you were recording for Penguins, because I know like Surf's Up by Sony, they did a lot of the, they tried to get all of the voice cast together in one room. But yeah. did you get to record sessions with John Malkovich and Benedict Cumberbatch?
No. And very, very rarely do we ever, on any movie at DreamWorks, do we ever have two actors in the same room at the same time, let alone a whole cast.
Really?
It's very different. Yeah, it's very different to the TV world, because in the TV world, they'll write a script and get everybody together, and they come in and they read through the script, and that's pretty much the episode done. You know, they'll go back and pick up the odd take here and there, but with features, it's not the same at all, just because of everybody's schedules, really.
And oh, yeah, I imagine.
So you just have to get all these people, you know, as and when they're available to you. You know, and very rarely are they ever in the same place at the same time. And, you know, even with Tom and Chris and I being on campus at DreamWorks, you know, they very rarely, actually through the production stage of it, we weren't in the same room at the same time recording ever.
Wow.
It's all separate. Yeah. And so, I mean, here's another little story for you about the process of making the Penguins thing. You know, we go in and we'll read the line typically 5 to 10 times, you know, at worst, if the directors haven't got what they want from you in the first or second take. You know, or Disney do this thing where they have like 3 takes. If they don't get what they want, they ask for more. DreamWorks, you know, because I know that, I normally just work like that. So there's a line in the movie where Private saves the North Wind from they're all strapped onto that machine that's got like the grinders and the spikes and stuff, and they're about to get you know, done in by this machine because Dave has captured them all, and Private comes in the room and he presses the button to stop the machine and he saves the North Wind. And I had done that line probably 5 to 10 times in an original recording session. And I guess what happened is they had a screening with Jeffrey. He wasn't happy with the take, and he asked for a specific take for that line. So I had to do a re-record. So I was working on Monkeys in my edit room. I get a phone call from the recording studio. Chris, have you got 5 minutes to run down and re-record a line for us? We've got one we need to pick up. And of course, yeah, I'll be right there. So run downstairs to the recording studio. And everything that we did recording-wise with the directors, Simon and Eric and producer Lara, it was all video conference because they're up at PDI and we're in Glendale, right? So they're on the video feed on the monitor in the recording studio, and so I walk in, you know, what do you need, guys? Well, Chris, we need you to re-record the line. I pushed the button. Okay, what was it about it that, you know? Oh, we just need you to try something different. Okay, all right, fine. So you jump in, do 5 or 10 takes for them. I mean, maybe not that many right off the bat, but then Simon gave some direction, and Chrissy, can you do a bit like this? So, all right, mate, you know, 5, 6 more takes. Then Eric gave some direction. Okay, I'll do it like that now. And so, you know, put a little pause in before button. So I pushed a button, you know, okay. Can you make the pause longer, shorter? Do it like all three of them gave me direction maybe 2 or 3 times. And it got to the point where I just stopped and I said, guys, am I being punked right now? Like, are we in a session of, is there a separate camera here shooting me? Are you going for the record of the one line that's been recorded the most times in an animated feature film or something? Because just at this point, tell me what you want. Just give me a line read, because I've done it, you know, however many times. And they said, oh, it's just Jeffrey had a very specific read he wanted. So I said, okay, just tell me what is. And so they did it, and I'm like, well, that sounds kind of like the first one I did when they came in the room just now, you know. So I do it again happily, and I went away, and I got in touch with the assistant editor up at PDI, John Dorst, and I said to him a couple of days later, I said, Johnny, how many takes of that line was there? And he started laughing. He said 64. That I think that will be a record for years to come that I won't ever break. That I said that line, I pushed the button 64 times. So what ended up in the movie? What ended up in the movie, those three words or four words, is probably the combination of three or four different takes cut together to get the perfect read that Jeffrey was happy with.
Well, see, now when I watch that scene, I'm gonna go back and think about this conversation and be like, absolutely. Man, that was the line.
When you buy the DVD, and then wind forward to that part if you don't want to watch the rest of it, and then you'll know the story behind that line.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for that you had to stay in it for so long. That's a funny story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's how it goes. That's how we work, you know?
You know what they should do for the video release? They should have like a featurette where they just show you in all those takes trying that line over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
to see how hard they work to get that line just right.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did. So we, you know, as we got to finishing the movie, you do some, a little bit of EPK, like making of type stuff. And that was the only time that Tom and Chris and Comrade Vernon, who was Rico, and I were all in the room at the same time. They had us read a couple of scenes through all together. There was talk actually back in the summer that we were going to do a table read at Comic-Con. And we kind of, I guess it was a rehearsal, for want of a better word, at DreamWorks with some of the storyboard artists filled in for those other actors. But Tom and Chris and I were there as the Penguins, and we read through the script. And for one reason or another, the plan for the table read at Comic-Con would went away. But that would have been really cool to do that with John Malkovich and Benedict. And
oh, that would have been cool.
Yeah, and Annette Mahendru, those guys are all fantastic. So, yeah, it's a shame that never came to be, but there you go.
Yeah. Okay, so, all right, so I've been following the Penguins since Madagascar. And yeah. starting at the very beginning of, like, your reign as Private the Penguin, like, how did you get the role in the first place? Because, like we discussed, like, completely unknown voice actors. In fact, yeah. They were, you had Tom McGrath, who was the co-director. And then you had Chris Miller, who was like a story artist at the time. And then I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Rico was originally Jeffrey Katzenberg.
He did do that vocalization, I think, in the first movie.
Yeah.
But subsequently, actually, to his credit, he said he didn't want to do it. Like someone else should have that part, you know?
Sure.
Just because it's probably, you know, let's get down to nuts and bolts of it. Jeffrey makes enough money. He doesn't need the work.
Oh, sure.
So give it to someone who's making a livelihood with being a voice actor.
Yeah. Cool.
But how did Private come about? So I have to go back once again to my days as an assistant editor on Shrek 1. You know, and so as you know, in animation, we start everything with storyboards, and we need Scratch temp dialogue to go with those storyboards so that we can build our sequences and see if we even have a movie worth working on. And so I was asked to do Scratch for one of the Blind Mice and Thelonious the Executioner.
Pick number three, my lord, yeah.
That's me. So, yeah, did those two Scratch things, and over the course of time, you know, I guess the directors, Andrew and Ricky, came to like what I had done, and I got credited with the two parts, the two roles in that movie, and so I had to join SAG, Screen Actors Guild Union, right off the bat, because I guess you get one credit's grace, and then once you get a second screen credit as an actor, you have to join. So because I had the two in the first movie, I went from there. So finished that. And then when Shrek 1 finished in 2001, that came out in 2001, then we rolled straight onto the first Madagascar. And the Penguins weren't originally in that story, if I'm correct. And it was Tom who boarded a sequence with them, with these characters that Eric Darnell had been working on for a different movie that subsequently wasn't going to be getting made. And, you know, between them, I guess they talked about taking those characters and working them into Madagascar. And Tom pitched this sequence, and you know, one thing led to another, and they needed dialogue. You know, I was on the list of people who could do scratch for the studio at the time. And, you know, I went into the studio, and they said, hey, can you do the little cute and cuddly penguin for us? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. You know, why not? You know, what more direction is there than that? And they said, pretty much that's it. He's the cute and cuddly one. He's the heart of the team, you know, kind of a little bit naive. And that really is the basis of how Private was born. Pitched up the voice a little bit, toned down the Cockney in the accent a little bit to try and make myself a little bit more understandable. But you never know, you know, like with the 64 takes of that one line I talked about, you never know if you're giving them what they want necessarily, you know, and so you just read the lines as best you possibly can. Like, what's one of the lines he did in the first one? It's no good, Skipper, I don't know the codes. So, you know, I did that 10 or 15 times just so they've got coverage, because, you know, I was always not sure if my voice was going to stay in the first Shrek movie. And over the course of time, I've learned that until that sound mix is finished on the stage and they're print mastering all the audio, your lines of dialogue can get switched out for someone else. It's that easy in animation. So I never take anything for granted. And even through the making of the Penguin movie, you know, you're never sure if you give them what they want. You know, they always have other options out there. And, you know, in the case of the Penguins, it's the, you know, the guys from the TV cast. And, you know, thankfully, they went with us this time. You know, if there was to be another one, who knows what they would choose to do. But I never take any of it for granted, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, here's a personal question of mine about Private. So why is he the only one with a British accent?
Good question. I guess he's from a different part of Antarctica to the others or something. I'm not quite sure. And how did he end up in? Maybe he came from like the London Zoo and was transferred into New York. That's a good story to go with.
Oh, maybe, yeah, that is one.
Maybe he started out in the London Zoo. They needed Penguin in New York. So
yeah, and then we don't know Rico's nationality, you know, besides his weird Rico language.
He's just a grunter.
Yep. So he could be from anywhere.
He could be from anywhere.
He could be one of those Argentine penguins down in Tierra del Fuego.
Yes, he could indeed. And you don't need to understand what they're saying to be able to laugh at them.
Yeah. So you mentioned that's really fascinating that you had to join the union.
Yeah.
Right after. Right after Madagascar, or no, right after Shrek, right? Doing Thelonious.
After Shrek, yeah.
Yeah, and the Three Blind Mice. Right. So how did voicing the penguins evolve over time? Like, did you all have to take, like, voice lessons, or did you, you know, did it just come natural and you just came in and recorded when they needed you?
Yeah, that is it in a nutshell, to be honest, Mason. I mean, there's no science to it on my part whatsoever. You know, I'd never done an acting class in my life, and some would say that shows. And you know, you just go in and do whatever they want when they call you and hope that it stays in the movie, you know, or the TV show or the short, you know. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what else to say on that one.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, did you do the TV show? That was on Nickelodeon. Did you do Private on that one?
Thanks for asking. No, unfortunately, that was one of the biggest disappointments in my 21 years, or no, where are we? 22 years, 23 years, something like that in the industry. The moment that I was sat down by the executive that had to break the news to me that my part was being recast for the TV show, absolutely hit me like a train and completely broke my heart, because I was so looking forward to being in a TV show. You got to remember, my kids, you know, my first daughter was 2 weeks old when I started working on the first Shrek. they're now 18 and 15 now, but they have kind of grown up with my characters as well, if that's the right way of putting it. You know, they've enjoyed their dad being a voice in these movies, and, you know, they've been able to show off a little bit to their friends at school. Not too much, but just enough. And yeah, so we actually got to record the pilot for the TV show originally. And, you know, first of all, there's this buzz going around the studio. There's going to be a TV show, the Penguins, in it. Like, great, I'm one of the Penguins. And, you know, there's no way they're not going to use me. You know?
All right.
And then get called in to do the pilot. And fantastic. What a great experience. And, you know, working with the guys at Nickelodeon, all those other fantastic voice actors from the cast are there, you know, that have had long careers and doing what they do as voice actors. And it was just a fantastic experience. And I loved every minute of it. And then, you know, you get the word that Nickelodeon are going to pick up the show. They've got options, you know, two seasons already or whatever. And we're like, great, this is fantastic news. And then you see a meeting pops up on my calendar with one of the DreamWorks executives. I'm like, this is it. I'm going in to negotiate my rate. You know, this is, they're going to offer me a deal, and walk in the room. And it's like, you know, Chris, we got some bad news for you. Oh, really? Yeah, we decided to recast your part for the TV show. And at that moment, I don't know what the expression on my face was, but I was absolutely devastated.
Oh, man.
But it came because everybody, you know, I can't remember exactly what year it was that they started production on the TV show, but I've been at DreamWorks all that time. I've got friends all over the studio. You know, I know a lot of people there, and having to walk around then, you know, coming back from that meeting back into the editorial department where I work, and with my close knit group of guys and friends that I work with we were on, I think, Megamind at the time. So it must've been 2008 or 2009, something like that, maybe even earlier. And they said, how did it go? And I'm like, they're recasting me. And they're like, no, they can't do that to you. You're the only British one who, yeah, they're going with a sound-alike guy. And, that was it. I mean, it was a very, very sad moment. But, you know.
But they recast some of the other cast, didn't they?
Chris Miller, definitely. Kowalski. And you know, I think John DiMaggio got to be Rico.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, Tom's still skipper through it all, and so he should be, because I think, you know, a sound alike in that part just wouldn't work whatsoever. Tom is that character, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's really made that his own, you know, as have Chris Miller and I in our roles, but, you know, I guess they were easier to replace for the studio. And, you know, who knows what the big wigs talked about the day they made that decision, but
yeah,
we found ourselves not in the TV show. But you know, we've got to do all the movies, all the subsequent shorts, and the Penguin movie. So, you know, my disappointment has been countered by the fact that I was actually used for the feature. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, wow. You know what? I think my favorite Penguins short is the Christmas Caper right after the first movie.
That was the first one. The first short. Yeah.
This is a part where, who is it? Is it Skipper or Rico that swallows all the peppermints and then they use him as like a peppermint machine gun to get rid of that?
Rico.
Yeah, that sounds like something Rico would do.
Yeah. that was another short when Private gets to save the day. He seems to have a recurring theme a lot of the time in the roles that I've had a chance to play, is that he's always coming up with the answers. Like they all take him so much for granted that he's just the cute and cuddly one, but he actually plays quite a big part in all of these things, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was a big theme in Penguins, was that Private felt like he wasn't useful, or that he wasn't as important as the other team members, who were all, you know, hoo-ha, we can karate chop people and stuff. And so, and how was it with that experience of like expanding his role into, you know, ultimately becoming like a hero and a more important character in the end?
That was fantastic to have that opportunity to actually get my teeth into a part where, you know, he's not just playing the naive cute and cuddly one. Although that is very much, still part of his character, that he's able to have some dialogue and there's that conversation that he has with Skipper where he says, it's my turn. I'm the secret weapon. I've got to sacrifice myself, that was great. And it's a slightly different level of acting for me, if you like, because even though there's been a lot of heart in that character through the years, he's never really had to put himself out there on that level and give himself up for the rest of the team. So yeah, it was great. It was a really, really fun experience, and something that I'll never forget. I'm actually currently looking for an agent. So if anybody out there listening wants to get in touch with me, I'd love to do a bit more different stuff as well. So.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. Well, you'd be surprised who listens to the podcast.
What has fascinated me this week, I've listened to 5 of your episodes, and it's a shame.
Holy cow, that's an overdose, man.
Well, I listened to Glenn Keane, and then obviously Steve, because I've worked so closely with him over the last 22 years or so. And I listen to all the episodes that relate to movies that I've worked on. So We're Back, Balto, and I listened to Madagascar yesterday. And didn't get around to Prince of Egypt before this morning. But, and just the fact that you guys, you're huge super animation fans, which is just fantastic. And there is, I have a Twitter account, and during the making of the last few weeks of the Penguin movie, started getting requests to follow other fans, and I've started chatting with a couple of guys in Japan that, don't know if they're going to get to see the movie or not because they don't have a release date there yet. And, they're devastated by that they might not get a chance to see it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's really, really interesting to see how diverse the fan base is. Excuse me a sec. Hey, I need to be quiet, mate. I'm recording still. Sorry.
Tell them it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay, but shut up. where was I? Yeah, just talking about how widespread and diverse the fan base is, and it's just phenomenal to be able to chat with people in Japan that know your characters, and all over the world these they released in 30 different countries or something like that, so that many people know you as that actor and or as that voice is just really humbling and just really cool to be a part of.
Yeah Well, cool, man. So I guess rounding down to our last couple of questions, which Madagascar production out of, all the films, features, shorts, and maybe games that the Penguins have been in, which one was the most fun voicing for? Or do you have a favorite?
It is very hard to pick because, I'm proud and happy to be a part of every one of them. But I think the first one, because that's the one where people fell in love with that character. That's the most satisfying to me. And we developed those characters, in the recording of it, or, over the course of the production there. And he started out maybe not necessarily talking the way he does now, if that's the right way of putting it. But, we evolved the characters through the course of that movie to be what ended up on the screen. So for me, that's the most satisfying anyway, that people fell in love with that character from the first movie, and the subsequent movies and shorts and the TV show have all kind of added to the fan base spreading and loving the characters even more.
All right.
Yeah.
So I guess one of my final questions is, after so many years in the industry, do you consider yourself now more of a voice actor or more of a production worker / artist?
It's a good question, because having had my little flirt with stardom with the premiere in New York and all that kind of stuff, and getting a little taste for what actors go through. That was fun. I want to do more of that. I really enjoyed it, but editing definitely pays my bills. So that's the bread and butter right there. And the voice acting is very much a secondary privilege that I get to be a part of very, very thankfully. But yeah, no, I consider myself an editor that does a little bit of voice acting rather than a voice actor that gets to edit.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, man, I just think it's so cool talking to you because you have this kind of weird, it's not weird, but you have this fun dichotomy of doing the voice acting, you know, which kind of started out not as an accident, but, you know, like you said, a scratch audio, and then also having this, you know, steady career as an editor. So I think that's really cool. And this has been a good episode because I don't think I've ever, interviewed someone who was an editor for animation. And then, you're my first voice actor that I've interviewed, I think. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Cool. Well, thank you for having me on. You know, props to DreamWorks for taking a chance on some guys that don't normally get to do this kind of stuff, you know, and we're not full-time actors, but we, you know, are able to play the characters that they ask us to play. And so, you know, thanks to everybody there that makes those decisions and allows us to do that as well.
Yeah. Well, we just want to say that we were sorry to hear about all the layoffs, and we hope you guys are doing all right and recovering.
Yeah, it's a really, really sad and disheartening time, but shout to everybody at PDI. They actually closed their doors yesterday, and it really was like, I've been at DreamWorks 19 years now. I've seen every single one of Jeffrey's public addresses to the studio, and I have never seen him as emotional, either good or bad, as he was last week when he made that announcement that they were closing PDI. So, and you could, I mean, there was an audible gasp of, you know, 1,800 people in Glendale and 400 people at PDI, you know, collectively. And it was almost like the air came out of the balloon instantly, and they haven't started reinflating that balloon yet. So, yeah, it's hard. Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, they are a very big part of where I'm at as a voice actor. You know, they've had to animate all of my characters pretty much across the board, from the mice to Thelonious to the penguins. So, you know, I have a lot of love and time for every single person at PDI. But I did just want to double back to that comment about we're back, because in the episode, I can't remember if it was Chelsea or Morgan, but one of them said they didn't get the point of we're back or something along those lines, and not many people did get the point of it. But the question was something like, why did they ever make this movie, or whose idea was it to make this film? Having been involved in it, I can actually, I don't know if it's an exclusive, but it was Spielberg's idea to make We're Back because it was supposed to be the Jurassic Park for the little younger audience. So Jurassic Park was supposed to come out and be the thing for the teenagers, and then here's We're Back for the kids. And I guess the kids weren't that interested. So there you go.
All right, Chris. Well, hey, thank you so much for being on the show. And we want to know that we appreciate your work as Private. But man, I've learned a lot about the process of editing animated movies, and your fascinating long career in animation. So just thank you for being on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome, Mason. And is, you know, once again, very privileged and honored and humbled to be asked by you guys to come on and be a part of what you're doing, because it's fantastic. And keep up the good work, you guys.
All right, Chris. Well, we'll let you go, but you have a good one, and best of luck to you.
And once again, big shout out to everyone at PDI.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks a lot.